The table audio is made possible by the generous support of the John Templeton Foundation and Templeton Religion Trust.
I think we ought to own our grief. I put it like this: if Eric was worth loving when he was alive, then he's worth grieving over when dead. Why would he not be? And why would I want to stifle my grief? What would be the point? But especially of men in American culture, it's expected that we be strong.
I'm Evan Rosa, and you're listening to The Table Audio, a podcast about seeking Christian wisdom for life's big questions. Philosophy is often associated with detached, neutral reasoning about the world, thinking objectively or abstractly about esoteric puzzles. But it turns out that philosophers are people too. And it's a refreshing and inviting and inspiring experience when you meet in a person both a formidable and incisive philosophical clarity, along with a presence of patience and wisdom and loving concern. Well, that's my guest for this interview. Philosopher Nicholas Wolterstorff split his career as professor of philosophy at Calvin College from 1959 to 1989, and then as Noah Porter, professor of philosophical theology at Yale University from 1989 to 2001. Even since then, he's authored an incredible number of books on everything from metaphysics, the history of modern philosophical figures like John Locke and Thomas Reed, justice, love, art, and aesthetics, and his most recent foray into the metaphysics of sacrament and liturgical practices. Not many scholars are so capable of saying something of such importance on such a broad variety of topics. I ask Nick about his only non-philosophical published work, Lament for a Son, a work and expression of profound grief written in the wake of his son Eric's untimely death in 1983. In it, you find a man unafraid to say what he really thinks, really feels, really fears, really loves. There is no pious talk here, nothing Pollyannish. It is frank and spacious, and it will unravel the tightly wound bandages that cover your wounds of loss, but with a kind of sober consolation, and gives hope and peace rather than despair and turmoil. What emerges are reflections on the nature of grief as personal, discontinuous, and fragmentary, the conflicted relationship to public expression of lament in American society, the theological implications of suffering and loss, and ultimately, love. For as he writes in the short preface of the book, every lament is a love song. In 2008, I think I was in a Barnes & Noble in North Carolina, and I'd been aware of your work in philosophy, and I just had this habit, as most young philosophers do, of pouring through bookstores, used bookstores, new bookstores, whatever. And I stumbled across your title, Lament for a Son. And at the time, it was just a purchase to have more in my Nicholas Wolterstorff collection. But then a week later, my wife miscarried our first pregnancy. And I remember thinking, I had already been reading the book when we found out. And it was a cradle. It was a net. Mm. And as I remember that experience, this is years ago now, I remember feeling that there was this great cloud of unknowing. I'm borrowing a phrase, I suppose, but it was dark. It was a darkness. It was my own particular kind of darkness. And yeah. And everyone experiences these kinds of life pains and suffering in different ways and to different degrees. And we receive these things as they come. But
sure.
But for me, your book gave voice to the kind of grief that I was experiencing. And I thanked you for this when I first met you years later. But I wanted to say again, for me and for many others who have been touched by your work in Lament for a Son, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm so grateful that you chose to just invite people onto the mourning bench, as you put it in the book, and were willing to share your grief publicly like that. Would you mind telling the story behind your experience and the thoughts and the considerations that went into doing this, putting pen to paper, writing?
Yeah, Eric was our second child, our eldest son. Was a grad student at Yale in the art and architecture department, was working on a dissertation on a German between-the-war architect, Schulze-Naumburg, living in Munich. He'd been a mountain climber for many years, loved mountain climbing. So on Saturday, we learned he took the train from Munich into Austria and climbed a mountain and slipped and fell and was killed up on the mountainside. The Austrian mountain police, or whatever they're called, found his body, and late that Sunday afternoon, we got a call from his landlady saying that Eric has had an accident and then Eric has been killed. Oh, it was like being tossed into a pool of ice. Somehow it both burned and was icy. Seems contradictory, but that was the sensation. So our fourth child, third son, called him Klaus, his name is Nicholas, had a ticket to work in Munich and would see Eric and would stay with him in his apartment. He had ridden with friends to O'Hare Airport in Chicago. I knew what his schedule was, so I got on an airplane and met him shortly before he was to get on and managed to get the ticket changed to me. Claire and I, my wife, have since thought, why didn't we both go together? But that didn't occur to me. So went to retrieve Eric's body. Then I'm sitting in the airport in Luxembourg on the way back. And boy, I had a long wait, 6 hours, whatever. Yeah. So began writing.
You began writing, that was the day after?
Maybe 3 days after. Probably nothing of what I wrote then remains in the book. But writing the book was my way of coping. In the course of that year, I read books about death and about the grieving process, and I found them just painful. I'd read 10 pages and couldn't read any longer because my grief was not about grief. It was about Eric, and these all seemed like a distraction about grief and so forth. So the book that I wrote, Evan, I think of not as about grief. It's a cry of grief. That's what it is. It's not about grief. I couldn't write about grief. And it comes in fragments. There's a lot of white space, fragments, then white space and another fragment. So it's not written through continuously. I think of the white space as silence. Writing in fragments just came naturally. Writing a continuous narrative just felt to me somehow incompatible with grief. I mean, death fragments. So the book is sort of is fragmentary. It reflects the fragmentation that grief produces in a person.
That fragmentary nature is in the experience, I've noticed.
You've noticed it too.
Oh, yeah. Where, try as you might to form a coherent narrative, I find my mind jumping, and it's in and out of memories, and it's in and out of different kinds of emotions. I didn't know that you wrote that with such intentionality, but I think it's fitting. It's fitting that you can jump from one expression of grief in one writer, and you can come back to try to articulate your own feeling.
So the fragmentary character of it reflects the fragmentation of my life and reflects what you just said, that one flits back and forth between images and emotions, they're just not continuous. To impose a continuous narrative on it is false to the experience. I tried as best I could in the book to never say anything that I didn't believe and didn't feel. Hence the fragmentary character of it. Hence there's no pious talk. I knew about the pious talk and heard a lot of pious talk. But for me, it was inauthentic. And so it's nothing I didn't feel or believe.
This is perhaps, from what I have experienced and from what I hear, other people, they bear a grievance against those who respond to grief, and they mean well. And they themselves encounter grief at some point. But there is a strained social interaction around response to grief. And it often cheapens. It often feels inauthentic and trite. Too quick, it fails to capture what's there, and it fails to comfort. And your effort to state those feelings, again, it's the giving voice to something.
So my experience was that many people, probably most people, don't know what to say. And when they don't know what to say,
right,
they retreat to what they think should be said and what they've heard said, sort of pious platitudes. Well, he's better off now. He's in heaven now. And
rest in peace.
You've got four others, don't you? And at first I found this painful, but I think eventually I learned to sort of blot out the actual words and notice the care and love that was behind the words.
Yeah.
That's easier in some cases than in other cases.
Right.
But
would you agree that the way we encounter lament, for the most part, in America at least, is very private, and public expressions often either take this slightly awkward, if well-intentioned, kind of interactions. But comparing that to other cultures where the show of lament is more public, it's a little more raw and visceral. What do you make of the way that American life treats lament and suffering?
So Americans, by and large, it seems to me, the attitude is you should try to get over it, disown your grief, get to the point where it's no longer part of your identity.
Detach from it.
Later on, somebody asks, so tell me about yourself, who are you? And then you recite it. And then the person who's asking you says, but I thought you lost a son. And then you say, oh, yeah. Yeah, now that you mention it, yeah. To get to that point. So the images, getting over it, putting it behind you, getting on with things. Mm-hmm. I think that's, I mean, it fits the American attitude of sort of being on top of things. So don't.
Being in control.
Being in control. And the way to be in control in this situation is to get on with things.
Yeah. And I mean, in some cases, that's just to not grieve.
Yeah.
And so it kind of picks up on the importance of a conscious grief.
Yep. I think we ought to own our grief. I put it like this. If Eric was worth loving when he was alive, then he's worth grieving over when dead. Why would he not be? And why would I want to stifle my grief? What would be the point? But especially of men in American culture, it's expected that we be strong. And I remember shortly after Eric died, there was a TV program I just happened to see. It was a couple sitting there. Their son had been killed in Iraq. And the interviewer is talking to them, and the man leans over, puts his hand on her knee and says, now, don't cry.
Yeah. Yeah. Talk about a really unhealthy stereotype.
Don't cry. Crying is the most appropriate thing you can think of.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's a sign of weakness to this culture.
Yep. So the book was published by Urban's Publishing in Grand Rapids, and we were living in Grand Rapids. Mm-hmm. The first time I saw it was when I happened to go down to their publishing house, and there was a wooden pallet piled high with copies of Lament for Some. First time I saw it published. I had the profound image, I can see it now, I had the profound image of lying on a surgical table, my gut open, and people walking past me. Mm-hmm. I'd exposed myself, and so I remember standing there thinking, what have I done? Mm-hmm. What have I done? Now, it doesn't feel like that anymore, but that was the emotion and the imagery that welled over me when I saw this packet of 200 copies on this pallet.
With a cover image.
And of the mountain, yeah.
Yeah. That speaks to, I guess, the importance or the delivery of sharing this. So to what extent was your grief a shared experience?
We in the family talked about it, but a thing I observe in the book is that the grief of different persons proceeds at a different pace. So when it was very intense for me, it was not especially intense for my wife, Claire, or our children, and vice versa. And unless you're aware of that, that can be very difficult because you say, why isn't my spouse, why is she so calm about this when I'm all broken up? But the next day it might be reversed, of course. Shortly after Eric's death, a friend of ours, Lou Smeads, happened to see us. And he made a wonderful remark. He said, Nick and Claire, remember, grief does not unite, it separates. Mm-hmm. That was a really wise comment. I had assumed that there's company in misery, and no doubt there's company in some kinds of misery. If the Cubs lose, you know, the World Series, well, there's company in misery. But there's not company in grief. Mm-hmm. It tends to isolate. Surprisingly, one would think the opposite. There's some uniting, but it's especially because you grieve at different paces that it can be difficult.
It's an intensely personal thing.
Yes.
Which is, I think, perhaps why ignoring it can be so damaging. So if it's true that we often ignore it to unhealthy ends,
yeah,
you're ignoring an important part of who you've become.
Yes, exactly. Ignoring it. Trying to stifle it. Forget about it. Yep. Yeah.
For more from The Table and Biola University's Center for Christian Thought, check out our website at cct.biola.edu. You can sign up for our regular email journal and get access to hundreds of free resources like ebooks, short and long form articles, thought pieces, all sorts of videos. Everything we do features Christian perspectives on the big questions. What is love? Can we grow from suffering? How can we disagree well? How can practices of humility and gratitude, forgiveness, lead to the good life? What does it mean to be human? For example, you can find original video interviews with philosopher Eleanor Stump or theologians Stanley Hauerwas and Miroslav Volf, or event videos from Cornel West and Robert George on how to disagree with civility and humility, psychologist Robert Emmons on the proven effects of gratitude for human flourishing. For these resources and much, much more, visit cct.biola.edu. Now back to the show.
Have you thought about what lament is? I mean, I'm not asking for a deep philosophical treatment.
I'm not.
You point out the resistance of suffering to be understood.
Yes. Grief is very difficult to understand.
Yeah.
There's something irrational about it. I think of it now as wanting with your entire being what you know cannot happen. Wanting with my whole being that Eric be alive when I knew very well that Eric cannot be alive. Mm-hmm. And that's... Mm-hmm. You might say irrational, but it's not sick. In a certain way, it makes no sense indeed, but it's not sick. It can become sick. I mean, one woman came to me who'd been grieving over her son, went to his grave every day. And in her case, I thought it had become pathological. But otherwise, when people have talked to me, I say, there's no schedule for it. If you still cry 2 years later, that's okay.
Yeah. It resists a rational discussion.
Yes.
But to speak of the ends of it, to speak of the purpose of it, and to try to foster, you know, a wider awareness of it, to button things up and put it away, it's not something to be ignored, folded neatly, and then stuffed away into a drawer. I think in the book you express it as you have become this kind of person now. So
yes.
That goes with you.
Yep, that's and part of my identity.
It becomes part
of
who we are.
I'm one whose son, Eric, was killed in a mountain climbing accident. That's part of who I am.
And it's just a part, but it becomes a very significant part.
Very significant.
It's a marking feature.
Yep.
Do you draw a distinction between lament and suffering? What is, I mean, I suppose suffering is simply something like the fact of encountering pain.
And of course, grief is a special kind of suffering. It's not suffering over a broken leg or something like that. But as I describe it, it's intensely wanting what you know cannot be.
Yeah.
That your son be back in life, be alive. People have talked to me that your child did not turn out the way you hoped and never will, became an alcoholic, or remember a woman talking to me about that. What cannot be can take a number of different forms.
So but it's a long
grief is that. And lament is in the voicing of grief.
Yeah. You say in the foreword to the book or the introduction, love and lament are just deeply connected, and it's interwoven the whole way through. It's one of these common themes about. You say every lament is a love song.
Yeah,
it's one of these very bittersweet moments in the book. It comes right away. That sets the stage. It does some kind of honor to the experience, and it invites the person to sing with.
Yeah.
To join the voices.
So I realized that, you know, love was behind it all, beneath it all, and so forth. But it was when a friend of mine told me that he had sent a copy to all of his children. And I thought, now that's strange. It's really strange. And then he said, yeah, you know, Nick, it's a love song. It is. But it never quite occurred to me to think of it as a love song until he said, you know, Nick, it's a love song.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
That's right. Would you mind reading this page?
No.
So it's just page 89. And really the question embedded there is, what is this connection between suffering and love? And what does the fact of suffering and what does the fact of an expression of grief, what does it say about the meaning of our love?
What is suffering? When something prized or loved is ripped away or never granted, work, someone loved, recognition of one's dignity, life without physical pain, that is suffering. Or rather, that's when suffering happens. What it is, I do not know. For many days, I had been reflecting on it. Then suddenly, as I watched the flicker of orange-pink evening light on almost still water, the thought overwhelmed me. I understand nothing of it. Of pain, yes. Cut fingers, broken bones. Of sorrow and suffering, nothing at all. Suffering is a mystery, as deep as any in our existence. It is not, of course, a mystery whose reality some doubt. Suffering keeps its face hid from each, while making itself known to all. We are one in suffering. Some are wealthy, some bright, some athletic, some admired. But we all suffer, for we all prize and love. And in this present existence of ours, prizing and loving yields suffering. Love in our world is suffering love. Some do not suffer much, though, for they do not love much. Suffering is for the loving. If I hadn't loved him, there wouldn't be this agony. This, said Jesus, is the command of the Holy One. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. In commanding us to love, God invites us to suffer.
The one who loves much suffers much.
Yes.
Have you learned anything about love because of this experience?
Well, I've learned that the one who loves much suffers much, of course. So, as I say in the book, I think, until he died, until he was killed, until he fell, I didn't realize how much I loved him. And I think that's true in general, that we don't realize how much we love someone until they die, have a heart attack, become ill, mm-hmm. suffer dementia or whatever.
I've got a recent experience of this, and it came in the form of a childhood friend. I fell out of touch with him after high school, but really we spent about 10 years week to week, close friends. Mm-hmm. We were surfing buddies. We mm-hmm. made mischief together as children. And I really hadn't talked to him for now going on 15 years. And he recently passed after a long struggle with addiction. Mm-hmm. His passing has unearthed quite a bit.
Yeah.
And
how much affection you had for him.
Yes. And of course it's tied in with, I lament not only his passing, but I lament falling out of touch and yeah. and the loss of that time.
Yeah.
And our paths took very different turns, but it's just this evidence of, I think you speak in terms of absence and presence. So in yeah. the absence of a person, their presence is very deeply felt.
Exactly. And as you're suggesting, it's typical then that regrets well up. That part of the grief is the welling up of regrets. Why didn't I do this? Why didn't I keep in touch with him? Yeah. In Eric's case, he was always adventuresome, always took risks. I'd warn him. But he loved mountain climbing. And I never said to him, Eric, you shouldn't do that. Just be careful. I've talked to mountain climbing people. They don't think he was careless. Mm-hmm. It was a slip of the foot. It was a spring. Snow was beginning to melt, so it was unstable. Mm-hmm. Should he not have climbed? Well, the mountain climbing people say, well, it's not so clear. So I don't feel anger about it. Regret, of course, and grief. But I don't say to myself, boy, I'm angry that he did it. I did find that afterwards for a couple of months, became extremely protective of our other children. Daughter Amy's riding to work with her bike, and I think, oh, Amy, I'll drive you. Don't take your bike. I'll drive you to work. As if, please stay in bed, all of you.
Here, just stay in the house.
Stay in the house.
We'll take care of you.
Right.
This is that risk in some ways. It's a different expression of the risk, but there's just a major loss of control that this represents.
Exactly.
We celebrate our illusion of control.
We're not in control.
There's this quandary as we observe those who encounter suffering. Some people grow from it.
Yeah.
And they are caused actually to flourish. Mm-hmm. And they become the benefactors mm-hmm. in a situation. They're made stronger. Their post-traumatic growth can be a rich experience for a person. And we see the opposite. We see that suffering can undo a person. Mm-hmm. It can tear them to pieces, psychologically, physically. Once we begin to kind of tease these things out, the question why rears its ugly head.
Yep.
But we also have this very deep puzzle about the human response to suffering. And in some of this, page 96 and 97 here, you say it about as much.
Suffering may do us good, may be a blessing, something to be thankful for. This I have learned. Ordinarily, we think of the powerful and wealthy as blessed. They enjoy what we call the good things of life. But maybe the little ones, the downtrodden people and assaulted persons, are blessed as well. I do not mean that they will be compensated for their sufferings. I mean that perhaps the treading down is itself a blessing, or can become a blessing, rich as any coming to those we call the lucky ones. Suffering is the shout of no by one's whole existence to that over which one suffers. The shout of no by nerves and gut and gland and heart to pain, to death, to injustice, to depression, to hunger, to humiliation, to bondage, to abandonment. And sometimes, not always, sometimes, when the cry is intense, there emerges a radiance which elsewhere seldom appears, a glow of courage, of love, of insight, of selflessness, of faith. In that radiance, we see best what humanity was meant to be. That the radiance which emerges from acquaintance with grief as a blessing to others is familiar, though perplexing. How can we treasure the radiance while struggling against what brought it about? How can we thank God for suffering's yield while asking for its removal? But what I have learned is something stranger still. Suffering may be among the sufferer's blessings. I think of a former colleague who, upon recovering from a heart attack, remarked that he would not have missed it for the life of him. In the valley of suffering, despair and bitterness are brewed. But there also character is made. The valley of suffering is the veil of soul-making. But now things slip and slide around. How do I tell my blessings? For what do I give thanks? And for what do I lament? Am I sometimes to sorrow over my delight, and sometimes to delight over my sorrow? And how do I sustain my no to my son's early death, while accepting with gratitude the opportunity offered of becoming what otherwise I could never be? How do I receive my suffering as blessing while repulsing the obscene thought that God jiggled the mountain to make me better?
I take it that there aren't good answers to these questions.
At least I've not found them.
What do you make of this fact that there are no good answers, or they're hard to find?
So what I've learned is that you have to live the questions. I suppose tacitly assume that my faith, Christianity, consists of answers to questions. And it does. But what I learned here is that part of it is learning to live the right questions, learning to live the unanswered questions. That can be precarious, but that's my experience. I don't have those questions that I ask there. I don't have answers to them.
Those are at the bottom, really.
Yeah.
When you dig and dig and dig.
Exactly. Down there are those questions.
Those questions are the ones that you have to live with.
How can I acknowledge that this book, many people tell me, has been a blessing to them, and that I would never have written it, obviously, never could have written it, if Eric had not died?
Right.
How can I acknowledge that and still say, it was terrible, it was horrible? Children should not die young. They should flourish until full of years. How can I say both those things, feel both those things? I don't know. I do.
Yeah. And that's just a very brutal fact.
Yep.
Poetry. You use poetry.
Yeah. No, I can't actually write poetry, but
I think there is a poetic nature to some of your expressions.
Okay.
But you also just quote it. You quote the Four Quartets.
Yes.
By T.S. Eliot.
Yeah.
That was my first encounter of the Four Quartets, was in Lament for a Son.
Oh, I see.
So you were introducing me to
T.S. Eliot.
To T.S. Eliot. I think I knew him for, Cats. That's one of the T.S. Eliots. But on the last page of the proper portion of the book, you know, the end of the book, after which you add an appendix of this beautiful requiem.
Oh, yeah.
Your son. But on the last page, you quote T.S. Eliot, and I'll have you read one more time. It's a short passage from Four Quartets.
We must be still, and still moving into another intensity for a further union, a deeper communion through the dark cold and the empty desolation, the wave cry, the wind cry, the vast waters of the petrel and the porpoise. And my end is my beginning. That last line, and my end is my beginning, is on Eric's tombstone.
Is it?
Oh.
You know, this comes from a much longer piece of Eliot. Where did you find comfort? You describe frustration with reading books about grief.
Yeah, I couldn't stand them.
But you're quoting a letter of consolation from now on. You're quoting confessions at times. You're quoting some poetry. Where was the comfort there, or where was the helpfulness?
So instead of the ones I quote, instead of there being about grief, they're expressions of grief. And when I came across an expression of grief, I mean, not a clumsy one, but, there I felt comradeship. I felt fellowship. I felt a kindred soul.
I felt that I had been handed a tool.
Mm-hmm.
Your book and the elements that you've introduced him. I've read that Eliot quote now at a funeral, and I now see it as a tool. I now see it as, and I mean a tool in the best sense, the kind of tools that you'd receive from your grandfather, old woodworking tools that represent effort, great effort, that represent something deep about the human experience and invite the user to be part of something. Yep. This has been, I think, the redemptive aspects of the book. If lament just is a giving voice to grief and to our suffering, our personal suffering, and we must encounter it at some point, then so much the better to have well-worn tools.
That's a good way of putting it. Yeah, good way of putting it.
And this is just one of the many ways I've appreciated the work.
Here and there does not matter. We must be still and still moving into another intensity for a further union, a deeper communion through the dark cold and the empty desolation, the wave cry, the wind cry, the vast waters of the petrel and the porpoise. In my end is my beginning.
What about this passage from Four Quartets made you note it as one of these tools, one of these things to give expression?
I don't remember. I must have known it. Well, I think it was something after Eric's death that led me to read the Four Quartets again. I'd read them before, but I had some vague memory of what was going on in them and discovered a kindred soul there. Yeah, so I think it was a vague memory of what I'd seen in them before. Now, of course, when I read it after Eric's death, there were lines that jumped out that previously I would probably have sort of read and read past, read over. So that's what grief does. It reorganizes your world. It reorganizes how you read scripture, how you read poetry.
It reorganizes your experience. I
mean, reorganizes your experience. It changes what you notice and what you don't notice, what's important and what's not important. It's a profound reordering of experience and perception.
I think your willingness to publish this is a great act of courage. And I want to say thank you again.
Thank you.
And I want to continue to share this, and I will continue to turn to it when suffering inevitably comes. Thank you, Nick. Table Audio is hosted by me, Evan Rosa, and is produced by the Biola University Center for Christian Thought, which is sponsored by generous grants from the John Templeton Foundation, Templeton Religion Trust, and the Blankenmeyer Foundation. Theme music is by The Brilliance. Production and engineering by the Narrativo Group. More at narrativogroup.com. Edited and mixed by TJ Hester. To subscribe to The Table Audio, check us out on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Google Play, wherever you listen to podcasts. Just search The Table Audio. And if you like what we're up to and want to support us or help others get connected, please give us a shout out on social media, a rating in Apple Podcasts. That really does help. And leave us a comment. We just want to know what you think. On Twitter, you can follow me at Evan Subrosa, and you could follow the Center for Christian Thought at BiolaCCT or visit our website, cct.biola.edu.